In this episode, I'm in conversation with myself. So before the episode kicks off and you spend an incredibly long amount of time listening to just my voice, I just want to remind you that we're running a giveaway on the QI Guy Twitter channel at the QI underscore guy, giving away a copy of The Culture Code by Daniel Coyle. How do you get in with a chance of winning that? You got a Twitter account, find the pinned tweet on our profile page, give it a like and retweet, and then you will be in with a chance of winning a copy of that book. If you don't worry, your name will be entered into the draw and you will stand a chance for winning future giveaways in July, August, September, and so on and so forth. So that's the QI underscore guy, the pinned tweet, and give it a like and retweet to be in with a chance of winning. Hello and welcome to another episode of the QI Guy in conversation with the last full episode in this third batch of episodes. We have had some great conversations again with people from healthcare, few AHPs, occupational therapists, folk who worked in improvement in industry and education. Just so happened to be it was all wrapped up the one person. We had a great conversation with an OD colleague who also happened to be a legend in the metalcore scene in the UK, which made me very happy. And again, I hope you've enjoyed the episodes, but I thought for this last one we would do something a little bit different, where I would basically just talk to you as me, in conversation with myself. Not quite. I'm not going to do the whole question and answer thing, but I kind of wanted to do this because in the last few months I'd been asked a few times to kind of speak at different kind of groups or meetings around about my QI journey or the QI work that I'm doing. And even when it's the QI work that I'm doing in my own organisation and kind of laying that out, I kind of felt like there's a lot of me in that. So even although first and foremost I might be saying this is what's happening in this organisation that I work in, it was very much kind of reflective of my kind of beliefs around quality improvement, and that was shaped by the kind of experiences and education I've had on the subject, as well as having been invited along to kind of give that kind of inspirational speech, as it was framed, to improvers who are going through a kind of quality improvement program, and I was asked to go along and kind of share your experience and kind of inspire them, which, you know, I did, and I kind of enjoyed, because let's be honest, if you are an extrovert in any way, you probably do like to talk about you like to talk, but you probably don't mind talking about yourself and your own experiences. Or is that the AN narcissist? I'm not quite sure. You can let me know. And another thing was reflecting back on some of the conversations I've had way back to the first conversation I had with Leslie Ann Smith and Laura Allison and Paul Bowie and others. I felt I had a lot in common and had a lot of kind of shared experience in terms of how I entered into the healthcare system and kind of worked through and ended up in this world of quality improvement, that I kind of thought, yeah, there's maybe some validity in actually sharing my story, you know, as a little kind of end cap on these 3 years worth of episodes. Because it's less obvious, you know, how somebody in a quality improvement role or a clinical governance role or kind of any, you know, administrative or support role within healthcare kind of gets into the role. If you're a doctor or a nurse or an allied health professional, a midwife, you know, even IT professional and some of the other support services, you kind of, you know, you leave school and you go to college, university, and you kind of study that thing. You study medicine or you study midwifery and you come out the other side and you're a doctor or you're a midwife. But nobody, certainly when I was coming through, was going to university to study quality improvement or clinical audit or some of these other kind of tools and approaches. And they certainly, if they were, you know, because there was formal programs at undergraduate level for like kind of risk management, it wasn't necessarily the aspiration that you would come out and work in health when I did the risk management. At Glasgow Cali Uni, there was lots of people there from different industries, not just healthcare. So it's not always quite as obvious, and it's usually a more kind of long and winding road to where people were at when I've maybe discussed with them. So I thought I would give you a little sense of my journey and who I was. So I entered into the world of the NHS when I was 18. At that time, we're just coming up on my 23rd anniversary, 23 years in the NHS. So, you know, more than a minute ago, you had to be 18 to be employed full-time in the NHS. I like a lot of people who go into health and social care. I had family members who worked in the NHS. I had an auntie who was secretary to an orthopaedic consultant. And when I was coming up on my 18th birthday, she said, "You go to college, I'll see if I can get you a little kind of part-time job or whatever, working in the emergency department of our local hospital." And I thought, yeah, sure, sounds great. And without word of a lie, on the day of my 18th birthday, I went to Law Hospital, which is just on the kind of outskirts of the town that I live in, and I had an interview to start work in the ED reception. And I'll never forget it. I was interviewed by two incredible ladies, Anne Smith, who was my first boss in the NHS, and Peril Adamson, who I think was Anne's equivalent in another area. So here I was, you know, 18, looking like only an 18-year-old could look with their kind of understanding of what kind of, you know, formal, casual might look like for an interview. But, you know, I think I did enough to think that I showed something that day, and it wasn't just that I was Matty's nephew. And I got the job. So I had a great 18th birthday, had many reasons to celebrate, as well as that significant age, getting a job. It was excellent. So that was a Thursday. So this is how keen my memory is for these things. That was a Thursday, the 20th of July, and I started the following Monday, and I was offered a bank contract. And those that maybe don't know healthcare or don't know healthcare in the UK, that's a kind of flexible contract. You're not guaranteed any hours, you're not kind of guaranteed shifts, but you're in a pool of staff where if they need cover, they can call you in. So, yeah, that was me. I kind of started, and I think I had 2 weeks kind of training and induction, so I was working every day for 2 weeks, and it was over the kind of summer break between high school and college. And, you know, I'm not a clinical person, absolutely not, but you know, I was kind of at the sharp end of healthcare, because I was working on the reception in an emergency department. So unless you were like really sick and you were getting brought in by a blue light ambulance and kind of whisked into the resource room, chances are you were going to come across me in the first instance before you seen a doctor or a nurse or whatever. So yeah, I had a really kind of steep learning curve about healthcare and about people's presentation of healthcare and how that system worked and how it didn't always necessarily feel like, you know, fair, or it didn't feel, you know, there was just something about it that could be kind of improved or changed. Maybe it didn't feel as efficient, and, you know, why is that guy sitting there and he seems really in distress and that person went through. And some of that was youthful naivety, of course. But I had a really steep learning curve, and in those first couple of weeks, there was a nurse come over from theatres. I think he had a needle stick injury. It was a chap, I always remember this. It was a chap, he had a needle stick injury, he had to come over and, you know, came to me first, and I took his, you know, name and address and all that kind of stuff, and why are you over here? And he must have seen something in me, said, "Oh, have you just started?" Yeah, this is my, I think, you know, end of my first week, second week. And he says, "Oh, you'll have a job for life as long as you don't kill anybody." And I kind of thought, okay, so dark sense of humour is required to work, in the NHS, or certainly to kind of be a clinical member of staff. And that is one of many lines that's been said to me over the years that stuck with me. But anyway, I kind of was bank for about 10 months while I was at college, and like I was saying, people who work in the kind of quality improvement world don't necessarily start out to do that, and certainly don't necessarily start out to do that within healthcare. So anybody that knows me will know I love music, I love heavy metal. So I'd been playing in bands since my early teenage years, and I'd went to college to do music technology and electronics. One of those ones where you're a good guitarist, and you're a little pool of friends, but when you apply to university to be a guitarist, you find out that you're not as good as you thought you were. So, kind of the music technology and the recording side of things, the electronic side of things was a kind of fallback. Wasn't really a passion, and that's kind of something to keep in mind for later on. So about 10 months in, I got a part-time contract working at the weekends, still in the ED, but by this point, 10, 12 months in, I'd pretty much touched every part of the system. I'd worked in ED, I'd worked in outpatients, I'd worked in wards, I'd covered medical records. I'd started to kind of work in all different areas of the hospital and interacting with all different types of clinical staff and housekeeping staff and porters, and really kind of starting to get an appreciation for the system, if you like, and how big and complex the business of providing healthcare was. Fast forward to kind of the end of college, and I was kind of unsure of what I wanted to do. I wasn't really that passionate about sitting behind a mixing desk, for 8 hours a day, recording somebody else's dreams. I wanted to be at the other side of the glass, screaming into the microphone. So I spoke to my boss, Anne, and she'd said, have you ever thought about a career in the health service? And, I was like in my early 20s, so there was, a question mark about if I'd ever thought about anything. But, I hadn't. Was the short answer, and she said, "Well, there's a couple of jobs coming up. I think you would be good, you'd be good for, and you should maybe keep in mind. And one of them is in IT, and I think if I remember right, it was desktop support. Running about the hospital, fixing computers and logins and printers and all that kind of stuff. A really vital, important job. But this was kind of before computers had become a big thing." When I worked in ED, it was a terminal you had, so there was no, monitor and keyboard and mouse and Wi-Fi and all these kind of things. There was literally a screen and a keyboard, and it was like if you're familiar with the film Tron, that's what the interface was like. You had a little menu, with numbers, and like say the ED menu was number four. You put type number four and hit that, and it opened up that menu, and it gave you another menu with, eight options, and one of them was patient details, and that was maybe number two. So you hit number two and you opened that menu. So it was really rudimentary basic stuff. So the IT thing didn't really kind of land with me, didn't connect. But this other job that she mentioned did. A clinical audit assistant, and I was like, wow, that sounds cool. No clue what it is, but it's got clinical in the title, which is pretty cool. I think I know what audit is, and yeah, sure, I can assist. But I did which I think is a kind of trait that everybody in improvement has, and probably a lot of people that work in healthcare have, which leads into that, is a curiosity. Curiosity to what does that mean? How does that work? What happens when you do this, and what happens when that happens, etc., etc. So I went away curious and kind of started to read up about clinical audit. And again, by this point, I was about 3, 4 years into working in the healthcare service, and I'd worked pretty much everywhere, every department that you could work in from a kind of clerical and administrative point of view. And clinical audit seemed to be along the same lines. there was a real breadth of kind of scope for clinical audit in the parts of the hospital and the parts of healthcare that it reached, but there seemed to be a bit more depth around it. You weren't just kind of doing basic administrative tasks. There was data collection and analysis and, you know, kind of understanding and looking at standards and best practice statements, which weren't necessarily things that I'd come across at that point. But, you know, the way that things should be done, and we collect data and reference and see is that happening and make changes, which was really exciting to me, because here's an opportunity to kind of influence and potentially help make some of those changes. So I went for the clinical audit assistant job and I got it. I think I was around about maybe 21, 22. I was about 3 or 4 years in, and I got the job at Wishaw General Hospital. For anybody listening, shout out to Wishaw. And I joined a fantastic team who really kind of took me under their wing and kind of nurtured me. Too many names to mention, but I had a great time working in that department, and I kind of, you know, progressed up through the ranks from an audit assistant to an audit coordinator, which is a promotion. And kind of leading some of this improvement work, so meeting with the clinical teams, the doctors, the nurses, helping them design these audits and evaluations, and kind of helping with the data collection and analysis and producing reports and all that kind of stuff. And I was quite happy doing what I was doing, but then my head got turned and I thought, oh, I could maybe do with a wee change. And Glasgow were advertising for a clinical audit coordinator, and this was long before the days of Agenda for Change, and Glasgow being the biggest health board in one of the biggest cities, obviously, in Scotland, you always found that the equivalent job to yours in Glasgow was at a higher grade. So I think I was a ANC 5, I think it was, at that time, and Glasgow were essentially looking for the equivalent job. It was an ANC 6, so it was like, again, I was young, why not, you know, a little change, wee bit more money, exposure. So I moved into Glasgow, and again, it was still kind of clinical audit, clinical governance, service evaluation, and I worked in Glasgow until about 2014, but about midway through my time in Glasgow, this thing called quality improvement popped up on the horizon. I started in Glasgow working in the acute hospitals. I was based at Glasgow Royal Infirmary. And after about a year, I moved into primary care, the community side of things in Glasgow, in the south of Glasgow. And just as I was making that transition, there was this thing called the Scottish Patient Safety Programme, which I'm sure many of you have heard of and been involved in, began. And it was kind of, you know, underwritten by this methodology, this approach called quality improvement and QI. And I was kind of making the transition to community as this programme commenced. I didn't really know a lot about it. And I'll be perfectly honest, I was a bit dismissive and a bit cynical of it. Both the programme and the kind of methodology, I thought, this is just the latest management fad. This is the latest way of, you know, the latest silver bullet. Because we'd had lean and we'd had lots of other things, and they'd never really, you know, productive wards and things like that, they'd never really taken off. So, you know, SPSP, QI, okay, whatever. I'm going over here. Thank you very much. So I kind of, and that was around about 2007, 2008, so I made the kind of change in the community, and it was another few years before kind of, certainly SPSP, because it became a resounding success, and if anybody knows of the SPSP story, it's probably one of the most successful kind of, you know, national improvement programmes in the world, and indeed people still, you know, 15 years later come to Scotland to kind of learn how we did things and, you know, learn how we've evolved and delivered that type of programme. So I think it was about 2010-11, SPSP started to come out to the community. So we had SPSP in hospitals, and now we had SPSP for primary care, for mental health, and mental health services are usually hosted and managed within community setups and partnerships. And with a few other areas of SPSP that kind of developed at that time, medicines and midwifery, etc., etc. So it was kind of becoming a bit inescapable, and again, this thing called QI. And some members of the team that I was in went out and learned QI, and I was still a little bit cynical because, again, clinical audit, you would design an audit, you would be collecting lots of data, and you'd be collecting it for maybe weeks or months at a time, and you'd then produce this report, do the analysis, produce the report, and take it to committees, and, you know, the whole audit cycle wasn't very rapid and wasn't very fast, but it was all that I knew. So my colleagues were going out and learning this kind of QI training from the guys at IHI, Bob Lloyd and Sandy Murray coming over and teaching them about the model for improvement, PDSA, and they were coming back at the office and going, well, you only need to collect data on 5 records, and you just, if you have an idea, you just try it. I was like, that just sounds so dangerous. There's no way that works. You need to collect data and so many things and take your time, and oh goodness me. But you know, I've always been curious, and I've always kind of quickly got over myself when it came to that, you know, that kind of hesitation, you know, because I have that, I think, just in general life, where I'm presented with something and I go, oh no, not for me, and then I kind of go, well, actually it's the worst that could happen, and then I go, yeah, sure, that's fine, we'll go ahead and try that. And I kind of did the same with QI. That kind of dismissiveness and cynicism gave way to kind of, okay, teach me about this, kind of let me see what this is all about. And I think anybody that's worked with quality improved methodology, rapid change cycles, whatever that methodology is, that approach is, but that kind of rapid change, that kind of cycles of change, data for improvement, to kind of just understand how good you are and what the experience of the patient is, and if you're along the right lines, it's intoxicating, you know, in a sense, because you can see tangibly what impact you're having right there and then. You don't need to collect data and go away for months and analyse it, put a report together, and then you come back and somebody goes, well, this is what's happening, and you're like, oh, I forgot you were over there doing that. You know, I'm very much, if you want to try something, I'll meet you down in the wards, you know, in half an hour, and we'll try it. We'll put something up in the staff room to get staff's views. We'll, you know, rip that page out of the, you know, integrated care pathway, and don't ask those questions for the next 2 patients that come in and see how it goes. And, you know, so it's very much that kind of DIY punk ethos of, you know, none of us are experts, we're all just winging it, but let's try it. And this business of QI, this particular model for improvement, gave us a bit of a framework, a bit of a safety net for doing all of that. So like a lot of things, again, in my life, that journey of being a bit kind of cautious and cynical and then going, oh, what's the worst that could happen, and then being all in. So around about 2012, I did my first formal kind of QI education, first formal kind of learning, and it was the Scottish Improvement Skills Programme, which I think, if memory serves me right, was the first time that Scotland had kind of taught Scottish people. Before then, we had been partners with IHI, and a lot of the improvement training had been done through the IHI Improvement Advisor course, and it was our IHI colleagues who had been delivering the bulk of that. But I think they reached the kind of critical mass in 2012 where colleagues at NHS Education for Scotland, Healthcare Improvement Scotland, which at the time I think was called Quality Improvement Scotland, kind of thought, you know, we could actually do this ourselves, so we could probably do it just as well and maybe a little bit cheaper actually. So I went along on this course. It was a 3-day residential, and it was the first time I'd done anything like that, staying over in a hotel and really being kind of immersed in that learning environment, networking and making new connections, which again is, you know, looking back now, it's such an important part of QI, and delivering the training in that way almost kind of bakes that in, that it's all about people and it's all about relationships that you have as well as the technical tools. But I went along and you know, there was a 3-day residential, and I think there was a couple of days either side of that residential kind of intro and then a kind of, you know, summary day, I just left it completely bought in. This just made so much sense to me. There was just a bit of everything for me. There was the framework for QI, which, as I said, gave you that safety net and that kind of, you know, this is, you could point back and say, this is why we're doing this. We're trying to answer this specific question, or, you know, we've got these measures because of question two, or we've got an aim. Why have we got an aim? Question one, you know, how are we going to test all these ideas? PDSA cycle. So you had that framework, but within it, you could be kind of fast and loose, but you could also be creative. And as someone who came from a kind of, you know, musical performing background, and that's what I kind of excelled at school, and, you know, thought I would be up on stage somewhere doing something by this point, the ability to be creative and have that creativity kind of embraced through QI just was, you know, sounded like heaven to me. So I did the SIS training, the Scottish Improvement Skills training in 2012, and that's where I first began to kind of make connections and start to kind of meet a lot of people who really kind of influenced my career. And at that time, I didn't know that, but that's when I first met Jane Merkin, Leslie Ann Smith, and a few other people who became really kind of integral in my kind of QI education, but also became integral in my kind of professional life, because they became colleagues. And, you know, I learned a lot from working with them directly and kind of indirectly through that observation piece. So I did the training, and, you know, I come back to the office and I was the kind of proverbial soggy dog, you know. QI is the way forward, and I was kind of shaking my dirt and you know, water all over everybody. And then I was kind of brushing up against the cynicism and the dismissiveness that I'd had, and people who were still quite not sold on QI, but I was kind of bought in. So all of a sudden I was taking these requests where people were kind of coming to our department, and people knew what our department did, you know, kind of clinical audits, longitudinal studies, service evaluation, you know, kind of things like that. And people would come and say, oh, well, we have to do this annual, you know, thing, this service evaluation or this annual audit, and, you know, that kind of thing. And all of a sudden I was saying, well, what would happen if we could have approached it like this, and if we did that, and if rather than reporting, you know, how things were in a kind of retrospective type of way, we could actually report how things are based on the changes that we've been making. But we can have a kind of narrative and a story to tell using this thing, the model for improvement. So we know why we want to do something, because previous audits have shown us, you know, things aren't that great. So this is what we want to do to improve it. And why don't we spend our time actually making the improvements? So when it comes to your annual report or your governance meeting where you have to stand up and give a bit of a presentation of how things are, you can actually show that you're doing things. And you're doing things differently, and you're learning, okay? We'll not say you're getting results, because QI can be a bit of a long game, definitely a bit of a long game, but you can always show that you're learning, and you're learning new things, and because of that, your you know, processes, your environment, your kind of methods, your materials are changing on the road to get to that outcome, that kind of what good looks like. So I kind of started to do that, but again, there was some resistance, because QI was very much still kind of seen as that thing that they do for the SPSP program. So folk were quite happy to do the model for improvement in PDSA if it was aligned to SPSP, because it was kind of like, to be part of the SPSP club, you had to do QI, and if you were doing QI, you had to be part of the SPSP club. There was this kind of weird interaction early on, so there was a lot of resistance, which was helpful for me, because it helped me reflect on, God, was I like that a few years ago? Apologise to a few of my colleagues. But you know, that's the challenge, and I would be lying if I said we still meet that resistance nowadays when I go into a room and say, hi, I'm the head of quality improvement and I'm here to help. You can see the eyes rolling, you know, it's kind of like, oh, right, pal, our ophthalmology department's down there, I see you've got some ocular problems being taken care of. But you know, you still get that resistance, and you get people who are like, oh, I don't need this. You just make the change, you just do it, and you think, right, okay, that's fine, I'll be sitting here in 3 months' time when you're ready to come back and engage with me. So that was, you know, that still exists now, but it definitely existed back then. There was also something else interesting happening at the time, which kind of was, you know, really kind of formative in terms of kind of shaping my thoughts, and I would say put me ahead of the game, that's probably too much, but certainly making me more receptive to the idea of a quality management system, was that in the early days, and I don't know that QI was necessarily presented this way, but certainly how it was perceived because of the almost evangelical way that QI was put across in the early days, was that it was QI or nothing, you know, or it was QI or audit, or it was QI or. It wasn't QI and or QI with. You were either embracing this new thing, this new approach to change, or you were going to get left behind. And I kind of thought, well, don't we need both? You know, we need to be collecting that data at scale to understand what's happening in our system at a population level. We need to do that both for our learning, but we also need to do that for practical reasons, because, you know, regulatory organisations ask us to collect and submit data and performance and all that kind of stuff. So it's not, to me, it was never either or, audit or clinical audit, but it was like, how do they help each other and work in tandem? And I always kind of struggled with how to kind of articulate that and make that happen. So that was always a bit of a barrier that I come up against, was people say, no, we want to do an audit. And I never quite could articulate how we could do both, or let's do one because we've got plenty of audit data that tells us that things aren't as good as could be. So let's not repeat that same exercise. When quality management system came along, and that's kind of skipping ahead, that was a real kind of boon. So I was working in Glasgow, I was now a kind of QI convert, I was involved in Scottish Basin Safety Programme, particularly mental health programme, but I just felt like, you know, and I was starting to educate people in quality improvement, so I was going to different kind of, you know, student nurses when they were out their education programme through south of Glasgow, and I would go along and talk about quality improvement and different opportunities to talk about it and educate people on it and try and kind of just introduce and sell them to the merits of it. But I just felt it wasn't enough. And then a job came up back in Lanarkshire. So back to the board where I started as an improvement advisor within their patient safety team. And went along, interviewed, got the job. And this is where I started to work with Jane Murkin, who, if anybody knows Jane, you know, Jane was one of the kind of early folk at the vanguard of the Scottish Patient Safety Programme and QI here in Scotland. And she's a really expert in patient safety and QI, and she's worked literally all over the world in roles and consultant. And here was I kind of, you know, working alongside her. And I just learned so much. It's kind of, you know, unbelievable how much I learned. And I thought I knew, you know, again, I was still relatively young at this point. I think it was maybe in my early 30s. So I was, I thought I knew enough. I got the job. Surely I know enough about QI. But it's one of those things that then when you saw Jane in front of a room talk about QI, or even actually just in a small room with two or three people talking about, you know, kind of small scale QI, you were just sitting back there going, I know nothing. Oh my God, I am an imposter. You know, because you were like, there's so much I don't know about QI. And as enthusiastic and as curious and as big a proponent as I am, I just you know, I don't know what I don't know, and there's so much of it. So I was very, very fortunate to get myself involved in another first. So I'd been involved in the first Scottish Improvement Skills Programme when I worked in Glasgow, but now just in the door in Lanarkshire in this kind of formal improvement advisor role, NHS Education for Scotland had basically come up with and started this thing called the Scottish Improvement Leader Programme. Must have made a real impact if I can't remember the skill is how I talk. So you'll have heard of skill, and I'm sure many of you have been on skill or heard of skill, and skill's now being delivered to colleagues in Wales and Northern Ireland, you know, so all over the UK. But this was again Scotland's kind of attempt to say, well, IHI have been in the Improvement Advisor course, I think we've now got the critical mass to do this, and I think we could probably do it a wee bit cheaper. So Leslie Ann Smith, who became another kind of mentor, massive influence on my career, was in NES at the time as the head of quality improvement, and started this thing called Skill. And I applied for cohort one, and wouldn't you know, I got on cohort one. It sounds like everything I apply for I get on, but I, you know, I guarantee you that I don't, and we'll talk about one of those in a minute. So I went on Skill, and again it was kind of, you know, I always say that kind of QI and this journey that I've been on, it's evolution, it's not revolution. You're kind of constantly learning, and even 23 years into healthcare and kind of 15 years or so working and kind of change and improvement, I'm still learning technical tools and the methods. I'm still learning on reflections about relationships and how they went with people and interactions with people, and learning how to do it better. But skill was kind of almost like a, it wasn't a light bulb moment, it's like a mushroom cloud moment in that journey. It was like, oh wow, oh my god. So there were so many reflections, were like, yeah, that's not what I've been saying that is. Oh, that's not how I've been doing that. Or, oh, is that how that connects with that? So I was on this kind of 10-month journey where I just, you know, I think if you had to chart my kind of rate of improvement, it would just be in a kind of upward line, you know, continually over 10 months in terms of my knowledge and my experience, and being an improvement role, not having a kind of clinical job or another day job, I had that ability to kind of leave those learning residentials or those kind of teleconference WebEx calls, if you remember what those were, and go and try it. So that's how you do that. Okay, I'm going to phone up, you know, senior charge nurse in ward X and say, I think we should maybe try doing it like this. Okay, I'll come and see you, you know. So you were learning and having that ability to take that learning and kind of pragmatically try it out and fail and learn and try it again, just, you know, sped things up so much more. I then, you know, I stayed in Lanarkshire, I think, for about 4 years, but about halfway through those 4 years, Leslie Ann Smith came to work in Lanarkshire from NES. So she absolutely very successfully set up this skill programme, and it had become, you know, a phenomenon and a juggernaut in many ways within the QI education world here in the UK. And here she was working in Lanarkshire in the same team as me, you know, through the corridor. And Leslie Ann was just an inspiration. I think anybody that's seen Leslie Ann speak, or anybody that's worked with Leslie Ann, she's just brilliant. Can't say enough about her. She has the knowledge and the skills around QI, but she just has a great way in terms of how she puts that across, where you don't realise that you are being taught some pretty cool stuff, but you come away from it going, wow, I know things. Hugely supportive. A big feature of my working with Leslie Ann, you know, is on a Monday morning, she'd be in her office having her little scone and her coffee, checking her emails, and then I would just pop into her doorframe and be like, I was thinking over the weekend, we should do this. And I don't know if she kind of was like, it was belief in me, you know, the Ted Lasso belief thing, or whether she was just like, I just want to finish my scone, beat it. But she'd be like, yeah, absolutely, why don't you go ahead and do that? So we did a lot of things in Lanarkshire, that's how they started, because I had an idea, Leslie Ann was supportive and kind of let me go on, But she was supportive in a way that she would come in when she had to come in and bring her expertise and her knowledge. And I think that's so important when you're in that space where you're making changes, because sometimes it feels like the unknown. Sometimes it does feel like flying without a parachute. But it's good to know that there's somebody else kind of falling with you, and they do have a parachute. And if you need to, you can go and kind of cling on to them and get that little bit of support, which is what Leslie Ann gave me. And I think we did some great things in Lanarkshire. So, you know, we developed a QI education programme. We delivered some tangible improvements in some of processes and outcomes, both in our mortality rates, which is a very important metric for how hospitals are performing, things like falls, cardiac arrest, all of these types of things. So, you know, I think we did some excellent work, but again, time to move on. And in 2018, I went to work for Healthcare Improvement Scotland. So I kind of like to go back and put all the pieces together and say, I had a plan. My plan was that I would work in hospitals, I'd work in community, I would get as much experience as possible, and I'd go and work at a national organisation like Healthcare Improvement Scotland, and I would be the most rounded improver that I could be, and I'd be sitting here now, the grand old age of almost 41, with a lot of, you know, healthcare experience, and it would all be deliberate, and I'd be the best person I can be because that's how I was designed. Well, we all know that's rubbish, and most of us, I think, go through a journey of, there's an opportunity, I quite like the look of that, I'm going to apply for it, and if I get it, great, and if I don't, I don't. And just before I left Lanarkshire, I'd applied to be the head of quality improvement, and I didn't get the job, and rightfully so, I didn't get the job. And it's probably the one time that I kind of really wanted the job, I didn't get it, and I wasn't annoyed or angry. You know, maybe you would have that immature response when you're younger, but I just kind of reflected and went, so clearly I'm not ready for it. You know, clearly I don't have all the things that I need to have. And that kind of drove my decision to go and work nationally, to get that kind of wider experience of leading improvement at a different scale, interacting with different people, making new connections, testing out actually my skills and my knowledge a wee bit, to see, you know, how good are you? How much do you know? And what have you got to kind of learn about your trade? So I didn't get the job, and there was no hard feelings, and Leslie Ann was a fantastic support, and we had really constructive discussions after that. And you know, I think like any good manager, she actually supported my decision to leave the organisation at that time and to go and work for Healthcare Improvement Scotland, which is kind of, you know, in my experience, managers kind of no-sell it when you say I'm leaving. They kind of act like, ugh, I've lost good people before, you know, you're just another one to add to the list, you're not, this is, you know, a wee ego. But Leslie Ann was like, you know, I think you need this, I think this is the next step in your development, and you'll be great, and, you know, that's what you want to hear, you know, that, you want that kind of validation, I think, it, and that positive validation helps you. So I went more to Healthcare Improvement Scotland. And there's a bit of full circle here because I went to work in SPSB. So from being the guy that thought it was, you know, the new kid in the block, ready to be knocked off its perch, to all of a sudden, you know, supporting how it was being implemented in health boards, to now being one of the team that was part of kind of designing and delivering and implementing it at a national level. And I learned so much over my 4 years at Healthcare Improvement Scotland, both in the application of the technical tools and being curious and having the opportunity and the time to be curious about other ways of improvement. So, you know, I sit here now and it's not just about the model for improvement, you know, it's about the best methodology, the best tool, the best approach for whatever your problem is. And sometimes it's the best tool or approach to understand what your problem is, you know, and get a really good articulation of that, and then it's maybe a different approach to actually make the changes. So, you know, I sit here right now, and when I have conversations with people, there's a little kind of, you know, carousel in my head going round, and there's the model for improvement, and there's the double diamond, and there's human factors tools, and there's the lean eight waste, and there's all these different things, approaches and methods kind of going round. And as I'm listening to someone articulate what it is they want to do, I'm kind of, you know, pull the band at arm and kind of say, okay, we need to take a service design approach to this, because clearly we need to discover what's happening before we begin to define and move into that kind of testing phase. Or, you know, there's something here about the elements of the system you're describing, how they interact, so let's use a human factors systems approach to kind of understand what's happening and throw up maybe what those issues are, etc., etc. So, you know, being at Healthcare Improvement Scotland gave me the time and the freedom to kind of learn and to try some of these things, as well as make some connections, more connections with our colleagues in other national organisations, which is how I've become a colleague and friend of Paul Bowie. And Paul, we just recently kind of had a QI rewind on the episode with Paul around the kind of human factors and system safety stuff, and he's always my first port of call when I have any questions like that. And I was able to kind of establish and make those connections through working at Healthcare Improvement Scotland. And it was during that time as well that I started the QI guy. And initially, the QI guy was kind of an anonymous thing. It was a bit like the first Iron Man movie. Everybody wondered who he was, and then I reached a point where I kind of stood up and said, I am the QI guy. Although it wasn't quite as dramatic at a press conference, but it was the same idea. And I started the QI guy not long after I joined HIS, because that pesky imposter syndrome again. So, you know, that way that you know, I described having it a few years ago, working in Lanarkshire, working with Jean Murkin and these people that infinitely knew more than me, and questioning what I knew. Well, I went to Healthcare Improvement Scotland, and all of a sudden I felt like I was back to kind of square one, and I knew nothing. And it was a bit overwhelming. And anybody that's maybe made that change from working in a kind of, you know, a local health board or trust, and then all of a sudden you're working at a national organisation, you know, NHS England or whatever it might be, you know, it's a bigger world, it's a different world. And I just like, oh. So I started the QI guy because I thought, this is where I can show I know. So while I'm trying to get to grips with how Healthcare Improvement Scotland work, and what they need me to do, because they didn't just need me to be an improvement advisor, they needed me to be a program manager, a relationship manager, a politician, you know, they needed me to fulfill so many roles in that national space, that I was like, oh, I've just spent so long becoming the kind of the QI guy, the QI expert, and now it's been minimised to kind of just 25% of my role. So starting the Twitter account was kind of a way for me to kind of share that knowledge and experience that I had, and almost kind of get that, again, validation of, yeah, this guy seems to know what he's talking about, so I could go, you know, and kind of whatever was happening in the day job, at least know that, right, I know what I'm doing here. So that's kind of where the QI guy Twitter account started in 2018. I left Healthcare Improvement Scotland last year, as you're listening to this, so that would be 2022, and went to the NHS Golden Jubilee, which is a fantastic organisation. As I record this, I've only been in there 7 months, but I think genuinely, again, once you get over that initial imposter syndrome of the first, you know, 2 or 3 months when you move to a new job and you think, why did they employ me? I don't know anything, you know, you know, it's a fantastic organisation, it's so supportive, and it's, you know, there's so much potential for QI in that site, it's unbelievable. And you know, I'm loving it. I've lost my train of thought. You're allowed to do that, QI. You're allowed to kind of stop, pause and think, what was I actually saying? So yeah, you know, moved on to the Golden Jubilee, and I absolutely believe that, you know, As a head of quality improvement, which sounds impressive, you know, and it is kind of a big deal now, but that's very much the kind of the totality of all those years of experience and working with directly and indirectly some fantastic people, because I've learned from all of them. I've stolen bits and pieces from all of them in terms of how I see them engaging with people, their understanding and explanation of technical tools, the way that they kind of maintain and build relationships as well. So, you know, I've got a huge debt to a lot of the people that have been on the podcast over the year, because you know, I'm very much, you know, a kind of a sum of all their parts, which sounds more grandiose than it probably is, but you know what I mean. I've cherry picked. So yeah, that's kind of, you know, that's kind of where I am. So I'm going to leave you with a couple of tips that I've learned over my years of kind of working in quality improvement and being an improver. One of them is probably go where the work is. You're always going to come up against resistance to change. You're going to come up against resistance to how you want to do the change. You know, the methods that you're kind of, you know, QI or service design or whatever it's going to be. People are going to go, I don't like that. They're going to be that guy that I was, you know, 15 years ago and be cynical and dismissive. They're going to be resistant to the changes that you want to make. So it's not necessarily that there needs to be a change or how we're doing it, but they just don't agree with what you're doing. So you're going to come up against lots of different kinds of resistance. So go where the people are invested in making that change. Go where they're open to how they do it and what they do. And work with them. That might only be one or two people in an organisation of thousands, but that's the first domino that often needs to fall to get people on board, because they can then see not only the potential, but they can see the actual benefits of kind of working in this way and approaching problems in this way. Second one is, and this is a big QI guy mantra as well, as my own personal mantra, but I suppose it's kind of the same. Get yourself some pals, you know, some friends. Get yourself some people that you can lean on for all different types of reasons. You know, QI, like any other aspect of healthcare, you need to kind of be resilient in it for different reasons, but you need to be resilient, because sometimes you do get that resistance and you kind of come back dejected. Sometimes you are in the engine room of making the change, but you're not necessarily there for, you know, seeing it up in lights and seeing it presented. You're kind of in the wings, you know, knowingly kind of smiling while the leaders or whatever stand up there and get the kudos for what they've done. So friends can help you with that resilience. Friends can help you with your learning and your reflection. And sometimes those are going to be friends within your team. Sometimes they're going to be friends from elsewhere in your organisation. Sometimes they're going to be friends from out with your organisation. And that's okay. There are people that I've got connections with all over Scotland, and thanks to the QI guy, all over the UK, and I don't have a moment's hesitation thinking, do you know who might have an answer to this problem? I'll drop them an email, whether they're in the north of Wales, whether they're in the south of England, or whether they're in the north of Scotland, or over you know, on the west coast, Northern Ireland. I feel like I can do that, and it really helps me. So, you know, those I think are a couple of key tips that I would kind of keep in mind. Don't spend too much of your energy fighting the resistance, and make sure you've got that good support network of kind of QI enthusiasts, QI friends that can help you both when things are going really well, but also can maybe help you when things are a wee bit of a struggle and not going so well. Okay, so you'll be glad to know that the episode that nobody asked for, but I somehow felt obliged to give you, is now over. I hope you found that kind of interesting journey, you know, resonate with yourself and perhaps the journey that you've taken, potentially that there's maybe some things that you can reflect on and learn. I want to thank everybody who listens to this podcast and interacts with me on Twitter. Your support and your interactions mean a huge amount to me. And like anything, you know, I wouldn't do it if there weren't people out there who were listening to the podcast and who were potentially using it. So I do hope that you get something from these podcasts and it begins to open you up to a bigger, different world around change and improvement. So with all that being said, or rather rambled, I just want to thank you again for listening to the podcast. You can find the QI Guy in conversation with wherever you get your podcast. Make sure you like, subscribe, leave a little review if you would like to. Make sure you follow us on Twitter @theQI_guy. And until next time, take care.